There we go. Cat's out of the bag now. So anyway, for the recording, Tim Alcoholic. So we're going to be talking about step two. There are three ways round step two. There's the shortest way round, there's the short way round, then there's the long way round. Now, we can't get away from the fact that we've got the big book. There it is. It's there. It's published. It's too late. If you or I were going to object to it being published, we'd have to go back to 1938, 1939, object to it then. But we can't do that. So we're stuck with it. So that's what we got. That's the long way round. So we're agnostics is a long chapter. It may not be the longest chapter, but it's a bit like February is the longest month, or at least it feels like it. We agnostics feels like the longest chapter to me. And honestly, with a lot of sponsees, you try and take them through We Agnostics. By the time you got to the end, they're 87 times as confused as they were when they started. So what I'm going to present is like the super short way round, and then a short way round. Then we're going to go through the chapter and say how I use the chapter. So the shortest way round, I'm going to use a word kippered. It's what, well, my father would have said. If you're effed, you see, I don't want to say the word effed in its full form, so I'm going to say kippered instead. So if you say to the newcomer or the person that's in trouble, you're kippered. Step one says you're kippered. You're kippered when it comes to alcohol. You're kippered when it comes to everything else. Look around your home group. Look at Susan and Clive and Bobby and Albert. Well, they used to be kippered and now they're not. If you do what they did, you'll get what they got, which is they were unkippered by the program. So look, they're sober and they're having a nice time. Do you want to be sober? Yes. Do you want to have a nice time? Yes. Well, you do what Susan, Clive, and Bobby did. And that's basically all that step two boils down to in essence. It completely bypasses all of that sort of nonsense about the higher power. And all you and my first step two was very much like that. All Doug said to me was the only thing you need to know about the higher power is you're not it. Which means you submit to the process and everything else takes care of itself. What am I praying to? You don't need to know. You just need to do it. What's prayer? You say the words and mean them. God, please help me do this. And then you'll get given direction. You'll get given strength. How do you know you get given direction? A useful thought comes into your mind, like call your sponsor, go to work, go to a meeting. Keep your mouth shut, you know, useful things like that. Direction does not come in the form of a fax from God, say, hey, this is from God. It comes in the form of inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. It looks like your own thinking, but if you look at the clothes label on it, you will actually discover that it's coming from a higher place. So that's the quickest way around. And if someone is not really taking on board much information, then that's a really good way of doing it. Don't be wrong-footed by sponsees who are sober for several decades or have postgraduate degrees or other signs of external, worldly competence. Some people scrub up really, really well, but in practice, they can no more take on board information than a completely rattled newcomer who's 2 days off the drink. If someone is very unwell, they're very unwell, and that affects everything. So sometimes this shortest way around, you'd think it would be reserved for the people who are still basically coming off DTs. Sometimes you have to reserve it for the people who are, as my friend Tom says, educated beyond their intelligence level. And as Don Pritz said to Joe Hawke, you know enough about recovery to kill yourself and others. Too much information can be as much of a problem as too little. So that's why the short way round is super helpful. Now, a slightly longer way round, that was the shortest way round. I'm going to do the short way round now, which is which basically covers the ideas in We Agnostics, but in a broken down form and without all the long words, without the prosaic steel girders, and other choice quotations. So this is how, if I have to present step two, in a little more depth, but without going through the chapter, this is how I'll do it. My mind is broken. It sometimes wants to drink. Drinking is a bad idea. If I obey my mind, I'm in trouble, so I need to obey something else. Let's call that thing God. And that's where you bring other people in. You know, is that going to work? Well, Sue does what her higher power wants and Sue's sober. Clive does what his higher power wants and he's sober. And this is where you bring in other people's experience. You say, have you heard, you know, these people share at the home group? And, you know, the sponsor says, yes. And do you agree that Sue and Bobby and everyone else were completely powerless over alcohol? When they were drinking, they had no choice but to drink. And when they drank, they had no choice but to drink buckets. That's definitely the case. The way you drink, is it like the way they drink? I drink like them. I drink like them. Okay, so we've just established you are like Sue and Clive and Bobby and Albert. Great. We've established that you've got the same condition. Are they sober now? I think so. No. We can't be mushy about this. Are they sober? Yeah, they're sober now. So they have acquired power that they didn't have. And that's what a higher power means. It's a power greater than your best efforts. So they've got a higher power. Now, don't worry about God. They've got a higher power. They've got a power. They've got access to a power they didn't have access to before. Now, this power, let's see, let's put you in the ring with this power. Can you keep Susan and Bobby and Albert and Clive sober? No. Well, in that case, that power is more powerful than you are. It can keep them sober. You can't keep Sue sober, but it can keep Sue sober. Therefore, it's not just a power greater than them, it's a power greater than you. And you've just tricked the person into admitting that there is a power greater than themselves, in admitting that there is a power greater than Sue, and that they are not greater than the power greater than Sue. That power is greater than them. You don't have to invoke any arguments about the higher power being a doorknob or the number nine bus. My friend Melody had whales as her higher power. We thought genuinely that it was the principality just to the west of England, and it wasn't. It was actually the aquatic mammal, the whale. She just had tapes of whale music or something, and I think there's a lot in that. But anyway, what's the point? The point is you don't have to define what the power is. You have to look at the effect of the power. Like you can't see the wind, but you can see the effect of the wind on leaves, on trees. And that's the bit that's relevant. So when people try to get all sort of scientific, well, I'm scientific, so I can't believe in God. Well, if you're really scientific, whatever God is, whatever is keeping them sober. That's the scientific approach. Something is keeping them sober. God is that which is keeping them sober. Tom tells a very good story about a woman who couldn't get her handle on the higher power. So, she stayed sober. She went to her meetings. She got a sponsor. She did some steps. And at the end of the year, she was hoovering. End of her first year, she was hoovering. And she was hoovering around this green chair in her living room. And that green chair was the green chair she sat in to drink. She drank in that chair for years, watching the television. And she realized in the year she'd been sober, she'd not sat in the green chair. And so she concluded, my higher power is that which keeps me out of the green chair. It needn't be any fancier than that. The higher power is what keeps me out of the green chair. And then you universalize it. You say, what? Well, if this power can keep everyone else sober, you have to presume it's going to work for everyone. If 10 people switch a kettle on and it boils, if you switch the kettle on, do you think it's going to boil? Or do you think the kettle is going to respond differently to you switching it on? Because you've got like special magic fingers or something. No, you have to presume it's going to work for everyone and prove otherwise rather than, oh, I don't know if it'll work for me. Logic would say, no, if it works for a gazillion people, it'll work for a gazillion plus one. And that's enough to get someone through step two without having to touch the chapter We Agnostics. I'm going to run through We Agnostics with some quotations on what I do with them. So first of all, it defines, this is on page 44, it defines alcoholism. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And the conclusion there is, you and I, O sponsee and I, have a problem with no solution within ourselves. How do we know? Well, we've done step one. We've established that we can't stay sober on our own. Next bit. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Now, what the book is saying here is there are two options. You either basically die of alcoholism or die without active alcoholism, or you throw yourself fully into the program. Now, this is an important point here, which is there is no third way. A lot of people think they can mess around for months or years safely by doing, like, you know, 47% of what AA has to offer and somehow remain safe. But that's just not true. So you've got to get clear. Those are the only safe option other than alcoholic drinking is full throttle AA. Next passage. There's a passage which starts off, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. And then it goes on. The point of that paragraph that I make is, so we've got a problem, we've got a solution. The problem is not lack of information. You've got the information that a drink is a really, really bad idea and that you can never drink safely. But that information is not enough to keep you sober. If that were enough to keep you sober, we'd all only need one AA meeting ever and then we'd be fixed. If lack of information is not the problem, what is the problem? And then the book tells us that this chapter is actually very well structured, but can take a bit of work to pull the structure out of it. So the next quotation is a passage which starts, lack of power, that was our dilemma. So information is necessary, but you need power. And the image that I use with this is, if you want to make a soup, it's no good tipping the ingredients into a saucepan. You need heat to cook the ingredients. So that's like information and power. And so the information doesn't actually really do anything without the power behind it. What is power? The ability to implement an idea. Let's say the idea is, I wouldn't bother worrying about that. If you can't do anything about it, there's no point in worrying about it. That information is not enough to get rid of all of your anxiety forever. You now have all the information you need to stop worrying for the rest of your life. But you'll probably discover you need a little bit of power to actually implement that. So we've decided we've got a problem. We don't have a solution. The problem is not lack of information. The problem is lack of power. At this point, the sponsee says, but I don't believe in God, or I don't like God, or I'm a recovering Catholic, or just, you know, the usual things. The book's argument at this point is very clever. It says, It's a matter of willingness. So it sidesteps all of the arguments. And so we have to understand what is willingness. Willingness is the state of mind which immediately precedes action. So if you're willing, what you'll have to be willing to do is to give this experiment a go, which means to act as if there is a higher power that can keep you sober, and you take the action first, and that will convince you in a way that no argument can. There's a little trick I get from A Course in Miracles to help someone that's super resistant. And it goes like this. Stage one. This is when I'm resistant, this is what I do. I don't like how I feel now. Now, I may still be super resistant to an actual solution, but at least I can admit how I feel right now sucks. Great. Next. So that's point number one. I don't like how I feel now. Point number two. So I hope I've been wrong. I hope I'm wrong. If I'm not wrong, I'm really kippered because I'm going to be unhappy forever. So I hope I've been wrong. What flows from that is number three. So I don't like how I feel. Number one. Number two, I hope I've been wrong. Number three, I would like a different way to look at this. It doesn't say that there is one, but if I hope I've been wrong, just the notion I might be wrong implies, well, there is a right. So I hope there is a different way to look at this. Four, maybe there is a different way to look at this. I go from hope to speculation. Maybe there is a different way of looking at this. Fifth, what can I lose by asking? So I don't like how I feel now. I hope I've been wrong. I would like a different way to look at this. Maybe there is a different way to look at this. What can I lose by asking? And that can just crack the door open. The next point. So it's hard to proceed with willingness. With the action without any notion of a higher power. So this is where the book says, much to our relief, we discover we didn't need to consider another's conception of God. Now that's a very clever line, because what that means is whatever God you decide you don't believe in, maybe, some version of the God you think you were taught about as a child or whatever, or what society is telling you God is, you can totally disregard that. You don't need to argue against those conceptions of God. You can just throw them out. And then you start with a blank piece of paper. So my higher power is whatever is keeping my sponsor sober. Let's start with that. Whatever is keeping people in my home group sober, whatever power of goodness flows through the universe. I mean, there are 100 ways of doing it. But you start with a blank sheet, or you rip up everything you think you know and start with a blank sheet of paper and go with one idea that you can work with. And there, as I said, there are lots of different ideas. And at the very least, I don't think it's a good idea to have a person as a higher power, even a dead person. Or indeed the AA group. And he's mu because the thing is, you don't have access to the AA group 24 hours a day, but you do have access, whatever is keeping the people in your home group sober. How about have that? And then it's a just a very subtle distinction, but then you've got something that you can rely on 24 hours a day. The next question in the big book, again, I think this is very clever. It says, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Note, it doesn't ask you to believe in, it asks you to believe that there is one. Like you can believe that the Conservative Party exists without believing in the Conservative Party. These are two entirely different questions. So, is there a power greater than myself? Is simply answered, well, there is a power keeping other people sober, and that power is doing something I couldn't do to those people. I can't keep them sober, but it's keeping them sober, so it's more powerful than me. So you've now demonstrated that there is a power greater than yourself. And that's how the chapter breaks it down. It separates out the question of, is there a power, from, could that power help me? Next, there's a whole passage about being handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. And it's a long passage. I'm not going to read out all of these passages, but I'm doing them in order. Basically, what the book is saying is alcohol is a great persuader, which means you don't have to persuade them. Often it will require a slip or seven slips before someone is willing to basically discard everything they think they know and just try on a new idea for size. The next difficult bit, or the next part of this process, is why should we believe that this power exists? And it gives the example, it's what we've already talked about, the other people in AA. And there's a whole long passage about this. What does it say? Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude towards that power and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. So you take the example of people in AA as demonstration that there is a power. There's next in the book, there's this appeal to open-mindedness. And it talks about, and it's a very long section, but about how open-minded people are about new ideas with technology. And if an old piece of technology doesn't work, then how ready people are to try a new piece of technology in the hope that it's going to work better. And then it says, well, look how messed up you are, the bedevilment section. And there's a line which is very misunderstood. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. Now, this is just, it's very rarely talked about that line, but I think what it's saying is, look, if you're willing to be super open-minded about the new Bluetooth headset and you're willing to pay 30 quid for a new type of headset you've never tried before, which may fail because you hope that your phone calls will be clearer when you buy it, that you've got the capacity for open-mindedness. This is a matter far more important than your Bluetooth headset. So how about you show the same open-mindedness with spiritual matters that you're that you show with material things? That's what that passage is about. And there's a little summary line which basically pulls together everything we've done so far on the chapter. And it says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe. So Sue's in a good mood this week after she's been praying. We had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work. In other words, you're jiggered. But the God idea did. Look, Sue's in a good mood. Sue's doing better than you. She believes in God. Next, it talks about the role of logic. And I think this is important. People sometimes think in step two that they're being asked to believe something or do something which runs against logic. And the book is saying the absolute opposite. And it's completely reasonable to think that if a gazillion people take certain actions and their lives are transformed, that it will work for you too. That doesn't require some leap of faith. That requires accurate observation and trusting people's stories about what happened to them. But there's one element where faith is required. And it's this. And this is the difficult shift. You can speculate that what works for Susie and Bobby will work for me. I can speculate that, but I can't prove it in advance because if I haven't taken the action yet, it's unproven. And faith is the courage to take the actions based on that logic and speculation. So again, it's like if you jumping off a diving board, 100 people jump off a diving board into a pool below and they're all fine. Now, you stand on the diving board and it looks rather different. I don't like water very much. I don't like my head going underwater and I don't like heights. This is because I'm a coward. very happy to admit that. And I'm weak-minded. Now, there's no absolute guarantee that you're going to be okay. Even if 1,000 people jump off the diving board, there's no guarantee that you're going to be okay. But it's a reasonable assumption. It uses that phrase in the chapter, a reasonable assumption. Faith is jumping off the diving board. It's taking the action based on the logic, the speculation, the reasonable assumption. So the logic will get you 99% of the way there, but you need that tiny leap of faith, which is the faith to take the action. It also talks about the universality of the higher power. Either God is or he isn't. Either there is a power which affects people's lives or there is not. Either there is people are getting sober randomly, or there is some system involved. If there is a system involved, it's a universal system. You go to any group for long enough and you'll see people of different intelligence levels, different education levels, different people who are smart in different ways. There are lots of different ways of being smart. Everyone's smart in a different way. And it's not like the program only works for one type of person. If you listen carefully, you'll hear all sorts of different people getting it. You'll hear people you don't like very much getting sober and getting well. You'll hear people you disagree with on everything getting sober, and the people you agree with on everything getting sober. So it's universal. God is either everything or God is nothing. It talks about, then the book talks about the capacity for faith. So if faith is being willing to take an action despite there being no guarantees, I look at the faith. It asks you to look at the faith in your own reason. And if you've ever, if you're like me, you've made lots of mistakes in your life based on your own assessment of situations. Yet, do you not go to your own mind for answers again and again and again, even though your mind has failed you before? So the ability to put faith in something, to take an action, to take a step without a guarantee of success. As a drinker, certainly towards the end, it was like Russian roulette. Sometimes it was great, sometimes it was ghastly. But I had the faith to take the action of having the first drink, trusting that it might be okay this time. That is faith. So you can pretty much demonstrate, if you manage to carry on drinking in the face of the dwindling pleasure of it, the increasing side effects, then you have the capacity for faith. This is simply pointing an existing faculty, this capacity for faith, in a new direction, which is at the program. So this is what you want to demonstrate to people, that you already have the capacity for faith. You just need to point it in the direction of AA. And then it talks about the inherent nature of God consciousness. It says, deep down in every man, woman and child is the fundamental idea of God. Some people will connect to that. Honestly, a lot of people won't. And if they don't connect to the idea of God being deep down inside them, then you can't argue it. There are lots of passages in this chapter that I skip over quite lightly because they just don't work for a lot of people. There are bits of step one. There are certainly bits, all of step 3 through to 12. I wouldn't take the risk of arguing with any of it. There's lots of what's in this chapter. And this is important, I think. So if people rebel against lots of bits of this chapter, let them. It's fine. If they rebel against step 3 or step 4, there's not a lot you can do because you're fooling with essential parts of the engine. With step 2, if you can get them through the chapter, great. If they hate the chapter, I hated the chapter for the first 15 years of being sober. So I have sympathy for people that hate the chapter. I got around it another way, which is why I gave you the two other methods at the beginning. At the end of the chapter, there's a little summary. And this covers the whole of the chapter, really. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his maker, then he knew. So that's the order in which this takes place. The reason I'm willing to throw myself at the mercy of a power greater than myself is because I literally have no other choice. And then you take the action. And when you take the action, you discover that it works. And there's a great promise. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. And I started praying in around August 1993 because I literally had no other choice. I kept wanting to drink. And for a few months in AA, people and meetings were sufficient to talk me out of it. By the time we got to August 1993, I was finally a month sober. Everyone's arguments failed. Like whatever it was inside me had grown to such an extent that it was impervious to the arguments of other people, even the great grandees of my home group, and certainly impervious to the meetings themselves. And so I tried prayer because I literally had there was no other card to play. And I prayed and the damn thing worked. The desire to drink at that moment just left me. It wasn't even a prayer for sobriety. I opened the Bible and there was a line, "Be still and know that I am God." Now, I'm lucky because it could have opened at a page about the smiting of the Amalekites or some Paul talking about how long people's hair should be. But no, it opened on the page about "Be still and know that I am God." But it did. I think, honestly, it wouldn't have mattered where it opened. The fact I took the action, I opened the book and read the line. And that was enough to open the channel. And something in me clicked and I thought, I don't need to drink. Damn, that means I never need to drink again. I now have something that can be relied on. Damn, I'm going to have to be sober now. I was really disappointed and relieved at the same time. So circumstances made me willing to believe. I humbly offered myself to the higher power, and then something happened. And it says he knew. Knowledge is something which you can't argue with. Perception you can, but knowledge is deeper. And that's the point. People start to take action and they have knowledge which can't be dislodged by arguments. All the arguments they've had for decades that are thrown out of window then. So anyway, that's everything I know about everything. So I'm going to stop there. And Alice, did you want to field some questions?
Thanks a lot, Tim. Yeah, the meeting is now open for questions for Tim, which can be done by the raised hand function in Zoom, or you can message me through the chat function and I will ask Tim directly, or I will send you the message, Tim, is save me asking the question then you having to repeat it for the tape. Or if all else fails, just wave violently at the camera and I will try and get to you. And with that, I'll open it up for questions. John, you waving? Yep.
Yeah, I've got a question at the risk of sounding really dumb. So in the book, where does step two start? At We Agnostics or just before it?
Okay, so the question, as I said earlier, I'm going to be repeating the questions for the sake of the backup tape. So where does step two start? It's not a dumb question because the table of contents in the book does not reveal where each of the steps are. I don't know if that's on purpose to make you read it so that you can't like skip to a particular step, but it's so at the beginning, it doesn't say where step one starts, but it does say, oh, well, this is step one. Like in the middle of step one, it says, this is the first step in recovery. Once you start getting to the higher steps, it says, we're now at step three, we're now at step four, we're now at step five. So We Agnostics is basically your chapter for step two. But I'd say this is the reason why it's not a silly question at all. The first paragraph of We Agnostics is actually the summing up of step one. So step one leaks over into the first paragraph of We Agnostics, and then that forms the basis for step two. And then also that itself leaks over into, so between page 58 and 60, there's like a little pause where it sums up where we've been and tells us where we're going. And it basically it checks one more time. Are you sure you've got step two? So there's some step two stuff between page 58 and 60 as well. But I kind of cover that once I get there. So maybe if this happens next week, I'll be covering the beginning of how it works and then all the way through to step three. Well, people might want to consider are situations with sponsees in the past where things have got really complicated or sticky in step two, because that might form the basis for good questions.
Okay, thanks. Another question, Tim. So based on what you just said there, so you know, like how it works and the actor and all that, because that's all written before it says we were now at step three, doesn't it? But that would be step three. That's just explaining about it, is it?
Well, okay. So a little question about how does the actor stuff fit in? One of our difficulties with the steps is the steps on the wall, or on page 59 or on the wall scrolls that we hang up in meetings don't fully match what's in the book. So like step 10 on the wall, we continue to take personal inventory. Looks like we keep doing step fours on things. And then you look at the instructions in the book and it's about maintaining awareness throughout the day. It's like completely not what you'd expect. And step three is actually like that as well. So there are, by the time you get to the ABCs, let me just get the book down. I don't have the book memorized. You need to know that. Saskia always says, I'm so glad they wrote this down. And I think she's right. So it says on page 60 that three personal ideas, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that God could and would if he was sought. Now, at this point, your sponsee is supposed to be like totally up for turning their will and life over to God. You'd think that the next thing in the book would be, right, though, this is how you take step three. And say, wait a minute. If you're going to be turning your will and your life over to a power greater than yourself, like you're down with the idea that with regard to alcohol, that's a really good idea. But the sponsee may not yet be totally sold on the idea that everything else is a little bit of a problem as well. So in the AA fellowship, the fact that everything else is a mess is brought into step one. So people try and squeeze all of that stuff into the unmanageability in step one. The big book doesn't say anything about that. It hints at it in We Agnostics, and then it goes full force in step three on, since you're already going to be turning your will and life over to God, wouldn't it just be easier for everyone if you were down with the idea, if you didn't have any like emotional resistance to it? So that's when you've got the two pages on the actor, hopefully to persuade someone to take step three on the basis that it's good for them as well. It's not just for the drink. It will improve everything else as well. So these are good questions, because the book isn't terribly straightforward with these early steps. It kind of jumps back and forth. Yes. And things are not in the place you expect them to be either.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
What we could do, Alistair, is if we've got... we've got a question from Claire.
Thank you. Thanks, Tim. That's fantastic. And this, there are so many questions about step two, but one thing that comes to mind is in the past, I've made the mistake of getting a little bit muddled about when I see a new person, and so they get sober, and then they have the new boyfriend, the new job, the dramatic change of appearance, and you know, doing a lot of fellowship. I've made the mistake of believing, these things in the material world have become the higher power for the individual, and it's all that they're doing. And I think at what point, so if I have a sponsee, at what point do you just leave that alone and allow it, and not judge too quickly that in the place of a higher power, you're choosing the boyfriend, you're choosing the job? Because it seems that when there's the shift away from alcohol, the energy is invested then into the things around them. And I sometimes feel like it's a bit quick for me to say, don't stop doing that or try to look at that. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah. So I think what this speaks to is how you sponsor, how you can help people and thereby yourself, you know. So whenever I'm helping someone else, it's only ever really it helps me as much as it helps them. So whatever I need to say to someone else, or I feel I need to say to someone else, is what my higher power wants me to be saying to me. This is the question of step two with the rest of your life, like later on in recovery, or people who are 2, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years sober. What does step two mean in those situations? When you talk about making external things your higher power, a very good definition of pride is the putting of self in the place of God as the center or main objective of one's life. Now, if you're focused on establishing a good romantic relationship and maintaining a desirable household and pursuing an impressive career, this doesn't look as though you're engaged in self, because it doesn't look as though it's about you. It looks as though it's about external things, but those external things are totally tied up in my identity, my identity, my value, my purpose, who I am, what I'm worth, and why I'm here. And what step three is asking me to do is to have my who I am, child of God, whatever that means, my value stemming from that. So I'm of infinite value because I exist. And what is my purpose? To be a channel for God to do whatever God wants to do through my life in the universe, as opposed to those things, those external things being the center and main objective of my life. A very, might I say, vanishingly small percentage of AAs in my experience totally buy the idea that the solution to alcoholism lies in complete abandonment of self. At least the first time round. I think to stay permanently sober, the idea has got to be bought at some point. My experience, and frankly, the experience of most people, is that what you need to do, this is your basic pattern. You get sober, you discover after a few months, weeks, days, or minutes that just going to meetings is not enough. So you get a sponsor and you get the idea. It seems very clear that if you clear up your past and if you submit the good orderly direction of AA and sensible people around you, and you achieve emotional balance, you're frankly going to do a lot better in your relationship, in your household, in your job. So it's not that it's not true that those things will improve, but those are byproducts of the process. They're not the purpose of the process. But that's very bewitching. I'm sure if you go to meetings, I hear it as well. People say, God has been very good to me because, and then they list all of the external things they've bought or achieved in the world. A friend of mine says, sometimes we say, if you want what we have, and then everyone looks out to the parking lot outside to see what cars people have got. I think Bob D talks about this notion, if we have what you want. Well, my sponsee, he said, my sponsee looked at my wife and said, oh, I'll have that. And he did. You know, this, if you want what we have, can be taken to absurd extremes. So what happens is you work the program well, and everything gets better. And you think, aha, that's the point of it. And then you hear someone say that blessed phrase, a bridge to normal living. Now, that's got to, if you want to know where that comes from, it comes from an extraordinarily good pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a transcript of notes for a talk done by an AA member at an external organization. And this, the image of a bridge to normal living is actually a very complex image, which can only be understood in the context of that pamphlet. And it's not really generally applicable. It's not a very tight metaphor. But the way it gets used by people is to say, well, of course, you know, the first few years of AA, you have to, you know, go to lots of meetings and do the steps, but really you don't want to turn AA into another crutch. And surely the whole point of AA is to get reintegrated back into society. So you need to, you know, we'll leave the little ones to do the service. You know, I've done my stint. I don't need to do any more. That's what most people do. And I'm not blaming them. I did it because it's what everyone is doing. A lot of people are doing. Then what happens? Somewhere between 7 and 10 years, it's usually around there. Some people hit it early, some people hit it later, but it's generally between 7 and 10. You develop a tiny little problem with gambling or massage parlors or toxic relationships or sugar or exercise, or you discover yourself so high powered in your job that you're way out of your depth and you have no idea how to get out of it. And then everything collapses and people either drink and never come back, or they hopefully, if they catch it in time, there'll be the so-called second surrender, when you really adopt the program as it's set out and you actually buy it. You do service rather than lip service. But it's just like the first time you do step two. The first time you do step two is largely about drinking. It's essentially about drinking. The second time you do it, it's a much harder sell, actually, because you look around AA and basically everyone is sober. I mean, some people look kind of funky because of some medication they're on, but at least they're sober and they're not taking, you know, heroin or something. So, you know, there's a spectrum there, but basically people are sober. Whereas if you're 8 years sober, and you want to look around your room, for your AA room, for how many people around you are, let's say, over 10 years sober and don't need to be arrested this week. It's not that many people. There aren't that many examples of people who are doing super well, who are sober a long time. So step two, can God really, and also people's drinking problems look really similar. You know, I drink a bottle of vodka a day. So do I. So do I, as everyone echoes around the room. Whereas people's problems at 7 to 10 years sober look weirdly specific. And so people look, they say, well, I don't know anyone that's overcome this particular problem in their intimate relationship with whoever, or I don't know anyone that's been the finance director of a .com. Your problems look super specific. And this is where, if you're trying to get someone through that, you look at the commonality of the seven areas of self. Pride. Are you consumed with pride? What other people think about you? Self-esteem. What you think about yourself? Personal and sex relations. How other people treat you? Ambitions. What you want? Security. What you need? And pocketbooks. Your money. Are you obsessed with those things? Yes. So it's not about the specific form that these are taking. It's about the content, which is your fuller self, as I was. And then you kind of have to introduce people to other people you know from other groups on other areas who've got through this and come out the other side. Scott Peck, whom I haven't read, but apparently wrote a book called The Road Less Traveled. It's a great title. And I understand people talk about, you know, the path being the road less traveled. I think that's your sell the second time round. Now, if you've got someone to go specifically to your question, Claire, of if you've got someone who's like 1, 2, 3 years sober and all the focus is going on external things. You can try and tell people, but as Maureen once said to me, she said, trying to give people advice in AA or guidance that they haven't asked for, or even when they ask for guidance, that's the weird thing. You'd think if people ask for guidance, they'd listen to it. But generally, they either resist it or they agree with it so quickly that it bounces off and doesn't actually go in. And then that, like, they're happy because they got a solution, but they've agreed with it so quickly that they haven't got a chance to implement it. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, same question. But she said, trying to give people advice or guidance, it's like shouting at a 14-year-old who is skateboarding next to the edge of a cliff wearing headphones. It's a great image. If you want to find her, she goes to meetings in Raines Park. good old Maureen. She's very, very funny. She was the one, I hope I'm not out saying anything out of turn and saying this. I had a very tricky sponsee a number of years ago that took objection to a lot of what I was offering. And she said, what you need to do is say to this individual, I don't think I'm the right person to sponsor you. And as you send her off into the night and walk away in the other direction, do not mutter under your breath, and I can't imagine who would be the right person. If Maureen said, we should have a session called Maureen Said. That could be a whole hour. Maureen said, if they want the solution, you can't say anything wrong. If they don't want it, you can't say anything right. So you can kind of, you're doing your job by saying, honey, you might want to watch that, like the 80-hour weeks and the Netflix binging and the like half a meeting. You might want to watch that, but they won't listen. So don't nag because it doesn't work and you haven't got time. What you can do, you don't necessarily need to wait for them to get to 7 to 10 years because although at 7 to 10 years, the wheels come off, the wheels are going to start squeaking pretty soon. And what you can do, if the basic text bit of the big book is not working, what you can do, the exercise is to get them to go through the pioneers' stories at the back of the book. One a day and pull out every general. So those stories have got a problem section and a solution section, like before I got to AA, after I got to AA. You get them to pull out quote by quote each line which establishes a general principle of how AA works. And then to say, how can you apply this in your life? And people find that completely revelatory. There's a lot of stuff in there which deepens and humanizes and personalizes the very dry principles, say between 60 and 62. So that's a very good exercise which can soften people up. The other thing as well is if they sponsor other people, they'll see their insanity reflected in other people. And that's the only thing which keeps me sane. It's not like fancy Course in Miracles stuff, although I do that as well. It's having like a gazillion sponsee calls a day and thinking, oh my God, this person's completely mad and just like me. And then the next one, oh my God, this one's completely mad and just like me. You know, it's not they're completely mad and I'm sensational. It's complete. They show me what is wrong with me and I go, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. So I think that's the only way you can help people. But if people are on the way out, you can't stop them. So don't feel guilty or responsible for that. You put out the little saucer of water for the hedgehog, but you don't stand over trying to force the hedgehog to drink it because it doesn't work. That's all I've got on that.
Thanks, Tim. Alistair, alcoholic, can I jump in with a question? you're working with a sponsor, you work through step one, you've worked step two, you're getting to that point of how it works and getting into step three, and relapse occurs. They may or may not have fixed ideas. Invariably, they do have pretty fixed ideas about what their higher power is. They come back and say, oh, I've relapsed, but, I think my step two is in place. You know, I have my higher power, et cetera, but I've relapsed. What do you do? What do you do in that situation?
Okay, so maybe relapse might be a whole session, like how you deal with relapsing sponsees could work. But the short answer is this. It very, very rarely boils down to step two or step three relapse. It almost always boils down to step one. It's basically, there's going to be a reservation about some aspect of alcoholism. So maybe the person isn't done drinking. There's still part of them that genuinely buys the idea that a drinking life would be better. So there can be reservations. So that's like a step zero thing. Are you really done? Then you can have people can have a reservation about the physical craving. So maybe there is a way of controlling the amount. They can have a reservation about the mental obsession, which is, now I've got the information, that's enough to keep me sober. I don't need a spiritual awakening. My mind isn't fundamentally broken. It's fundamentally sound. I've just put the missing jigsaw puzzle piece in and now I'm fine. Even if people believe that they're doomed by their alcoholic mind to drink, and once they drink, they're doomed to drink buckets, a lot of people will calculate the cost of a slip and conclude that it's somehow worth it, because if it gets bad enough, I can come back. But that's a fallacy. Just because you've come back a dozen times doesn't mean the next time is going to be different. Because when Dr. Jekyll turns into Mr. Hyde, Mr. Hyde doesn't turn back into Dr. Jekyll as an act of the will. Just the potion wears off. Mr. Hyde does not want to become Dr. Jekyll again. And one day, the potion ain't going to wear off. So that's why there's no such thing as a safe slip. 19 out of 20 cases, I think, with sponsees who slip, it's because there's a reservation. They think they can get away with a bit more drinking before they buckle down. Once you know that if you really believe that your mind is so nuts, it could induce you to have a drink, and that you might literally never come back and suffer horrible pain for the next 30 or 40 years. If you genuinely believe that, then step two stops being a problem and step three stops being a problem. I think it's all down to step one. That's the short answer, although there are lots of variations on that theme.
Does anyone else have a question for Tim on this topic? Susie.
Hi. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, everybody. I don't know if you can answer this in short, but how do I get to a place where I really, really believe that God is everything or God is nothing? It's like, and nothing in between?
So the question is, how do you get to a point where you believe that God is everything, not nothing, and that there's nothing in between? The question is very abstract, so it needs to be made concrete to be answered. Chuck Chamberlain does this very well in A New Pair of Glasses, which is available, if you can't find it, from Smile God Loves You, which is a website where they sell AA stuff. I think it's called Smile God Loves You, something like that. If you look it up on there, you'll be able to get it for like $5 or something, plus like $47 postage to whatever country you live in. What he says in there is, if I have one problem that can't be solved, then I might as well just jump off a bridge now. If there is one problem that can't be solved or accepted, it's going to sit there like a pain inside me for the rest of my life. So I would make it very concrete. So believing that God is everything means that there is no problem which cannot be solved practically or accepted cheerfully and gracefully. So there are some things, I've got a couple of physical things wrong with me, which can't be fixed. And I've accepted them. And I shouldn't be able to, but I have. And so that's how you do it. You look at the practical level. Why do I think God can't provide me with a practical or spiritual solution to this? And it's very hard to argue against the universality of God then, because if you go to enough meetings, you'll find someone who's had that problem. Especially if you go to old timers meetings, you'll see every year a number of people who are sober 20, 30, 40 years who have cancer and sometimes die of cancer and remain full of grace throughout the whole thing. It's like, you know, what is commonly cited as like the worst thing that can happen is something you see people living through, or the death of close relatives, which is something I've lived through as well. So I think that's the art. That's how I come at that question myself.
Anyone else? Okay, I think it's probably about time to if I could hand it over to you, back to you, Tim, to close out with the Serenity Prayer.
Thank you. Would you please help me close with the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change,
courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you very much.
Nice one, everyone. Thanks, Tim.